she asked.
I think I just did. Don't call policeman for a while, she said. She gave me a haunted, harried look. I have my own legal problem.
Yeah, all right, I said. But I found I couldn't look at her, and my voice curdled with distaste. I was sorry for her and glad she was safe, but it didn't mean I had to like her. She'd had her fun teasing Andropov about how she was going to jump into bed with the dykes upstairs, using us as a cudgel to batter his masculinity. She'd been doing it the day the hard rain fell. That was why Andropov had come home in such a hurry, not to beat the storm, but to beat his girlfriend. In her own way, she wasn't much better than Gumby, who loathed Yolanda for being a queer. We had never been people to Martina. We were just a blot on the local environment, something she could rub her ignorant boyfriend's face in when she needed a cheap thrill. Maybe she registered some of the contempt in my tone. She softened, took a step toward me on her delicate feet. I am sorry for Yolinda. She was very special. I see her die from the window. Her cornflower blue eyes took on a guilty, shamed aspect, and she added, I am sorry about things I say to Rudy, about how you both make me lesbian. I am shit, you know? She shrugged, then smiled and blinked at tears in her long lashes. You a real badass beach, you know? You saved my worthless ass today. You are like if Miss Maple have baby with Rambo Bamboa. She turned and put her hands in the pockets of a tight leather coat she'd found somewhere and went down the steps, crystal nails crunching under her heels. Where are you going? The air was heavy, so heavy it required an act of will to draw a full breath. In the 10 minutes I'd been inside, that ghostly impression of a distant thunderhead had darkened and filled in to become a looming mass, pretty as a facial tumor. Martina turned back, answered with a shrug.
Maybe down to university. I have friends there. She laughed bitterly. No, this is a lie. I have people I can sell drugs to there.
So they'll think of you fondly, then. Go on. Just don't take any detours. The weather is about to turn ugly.
She looked up from under her carefully tweezed eyebrows, then nodded and turned away. I sat on the top step and watched her go, walking at first, then breaking into a half jog. Martina had only just disappeared around the corner when the door crashed open behind me, and Andropov stumbled out. Blood and snot had dried over his upper lip, and his eyes were bloodshot, as if he'd been up for 24 hours with only a bottle of vodka for company.
"Martina!" he screamed. "Martina, come back! Come back! I am sorry!"
"Forget it, brother," I said. "That plane flew already." He staggered to the edge of the porch and dropped down to sit beside me, clutching his head and crying helplessly.
No, I have no one. Everything fucked me in the ass. Everyone is dying, and I have no friend and no woman.
He opened his mouth so wide I could see his back teeth, and he sobbed in a great booming voice.
I have no place to go where I am not alone.
There is a place with us. Elder Bent said softly. There's work for you to do and secrets to learn, a bed to sleep in and dreams to dream. Your voice belongs with ours, Rudolf Andropov, singing the curtain down on the world.
While I was lost in my thoughts and Andropov was lost in his sorrows, Bent had come to the bottom of the porch steps. He stood there with his hands folded at his waist, smiling placidly. In the weird gathering stormlight of the afternoon, the planets on his skull seemed alight with a sickly glow. His daughters and a small delegation of worshippers were behind him in their gowns. The girls began to hum softly, a melody I recognized but couldn't place, something sickly sweet and almost sad. Andropov stared at them with wide, straining eyes and a dazed wonder on his face. I kind of wished I'd held on to the wrench. I stood and backed off a few steps, putting the railing between me and the crazies. All that harmonizing together is going to be good practice for singing on a chain gang, I said. If you haven't heard from the state police yet, count yourselves lucky. They've got the three who jumped on me on the interstate, and they'll be coming for you next.
The police have come and gone, Elder Bent said, and he smiled apologetically.
Randy, Pat, and Sean acted without my knowledge. They were the ones who first saw Andropa's note slipped under the door, and they decided to spring upon you without ever discussing their plan with me. I think they believed they were protecting me, as if I have any reason to fear the law. Yes, I knew that the storms were coming, but prophecy is not culpability. When I saw the note myself and my daughters told me what Sean and his friends were off to do, I immediately contacted local authorities to warn them what was afoot. I am so, so terribly sorry the police weren't able to prevent them from attacking you. But of course, law enforcement is badly stretched thin right now. You weren't hurt, were you? Andropov and I spoke at almost the same time. The Russian said, "What note?" I said, "Wait, Andropov left a note?" Sean said they got a message from him, but I thought they meant a voicemail or something. How do you know this note was from Andropov? Did he sign it? One corner of Elder Bent's mouth turned up in a wry smile. He has a rather interesting phonetic spelling of your name. Onisuk. It's quite unmistakable. "I leave note?" Andropov said, sounding genuinely baffled. "I must have been so high. I don't remember this note." "Good," Elder Ben said. "Let it all go. The note, Martina, your sadness, the whole life you had until this moment. A new life begins right now, today, if you want it. You're looking for community, for a place where you don't need to be alone, and we've been looking for you, Rudy. If you're ready to do work that means something and to be among people who will love you and ask you only to love them, then we're here for you. We're ready to say hello." And on cue, the girls behind him broke into Lionel Richie's hello, asking Andropov if it was them he'd been looking for. If I hadn't been so confused and stunned, I would have gagged. Andropov, though, stared at them like one inspired, his tears drying on his cheeks. Elder Bent held out one hand, and Andropov took it. The bald, gangly monk of madness pulled the Russian to his feet and led him down the steps. One of the comet cultists zoomed in and hung an astrolabe around his neck and kissed his cheek. Andropov stared down at it in wonder, fingered it in fascination. "A map to the stars," Elder Bent said. "Keep it with you. We'll be going there soon. We wouldn't want you to get lost." They moved away across the lawn, gathered around Andropov and singing in their sweet, harmless, senseless voices. As they slipped one by one into the house next door, their music faded, and another sound took its place, a loud, steely clack, like someone cocking a gun. Only it wasn't a gun. It came again and again. It was a manual typewriter. I turned and looked at the open bay door to Ursula's garage. From where I stood, I could see only darkness within. I crossed the street, worn down from the heat and the walk and fighting evil. Except that wasn't it. What had tired me out the most was thinking about all the hours I'd spent in that garage, seeing everything and observing nothing. Templeton stood at his daddy's workbench, feet planted on a big white plastic tub of rock salt so he could reach the keys of the antique typewriter. "Hey there, Templeton," I said. "Hello, honeysuckle," he said without looking up. "Where's your mom, kiddo?" "Inside, lying down, or maybe on her computer. She spends a lot of time on her computer, watching the weather." I settled in behind him, ruffled his hair. "Hey, Temp, remember when you told me you go flying every night to look for your daddy in the clouds? Is that something you do in your dreams?" "No," he said. "I go with Mommy, in the crop duster. I pretend I'm a bat." "Uh-huh," I said. My gaze drifted to the framed Ph.D. hung above the workbench. I'd never wondered what Templeton's father had a Ph.D. in, but wasn't surprised to see that his field of study had been applied chemical engineering. I wondered if the company that had fired him still had offices somewhere in the United States, or if they'd completely relocated to Georgia. Yolanda had told me that Mr. Blake's company had moved down south, a natural mix-up. When you heard that someone was moving to Georgia, you didn't think they meant Russia. "Can I see something, Templeton?" I said. "Jump down for a moment, will you?" He obediently hopped down off the white plastic tub of rock salt. I pried off the lid and looked in at glittering silver dust. At a glance, a person might have imagined it was salt, but when I stuck a finger in, it pricked my finger like a pile of broken glass. I wiped my hand on my hip and stood up. Templeton had backed a few steps away, ceding his place at the typewriter. I cranked the silver carriage release lever to start a new line and began to type. Little steel hammers fell, bang, 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 all except for the H and E, which wouldn't fire. I wrote honeysuck and quit. I thought about the letter in the paper, Allah with no H, the word body spelled B-O-D-Y-S to avoid the E. "What you writin', Hemingway?" someone said from behind me, a male voice. I spun, my heart banging like the keys of Templeton's typewriter. Mark Despot had crept to the entrance of the garage and stood peering in at me, tall, rangy, muscular son of a bitch in a white straw cowboy hat, blue denim shirt buttoned only at the collar so it flapped open to show the ornate X on his chest. "Mark!" I cried. "Why are you here?" Not that I cared. I'd never been so happy to see a friendly face. He wandered into the dim garage. It was increasingly looking like twilight outside. "Why you think I'm here? I'm looking for you." "Here? How'd you know to find me here?" "You told me, Sherlock, remember? You said if you weren't in the big white house across the street to look in the butter-colored ranch. You got anything to drink? I've walked half the day to bring this back to you, and I've worked up a considerable thirst in the process." He pulled a rectangle of slick black glass out of his back pocket. "My phone! How is it you have my phone?" He thumbed his hat back on his brow. "Well, I caught up to the lady that took it from you and asked nice. The trick is to use the magic word, which is please. It works specially well if you're holding them upside down by the ankles at the time." "Let me have it." "Catch," he said. He gave it a soft, underhanded lob, and it wrapped me in the chest and fell into my hands, and I had it for an instant, and it slipped through my butter fingers and struck the concrete with a crack. As a finishing touch, I kicked it and heard it skid under the work table. "Oh, crickets," I shouted. "Give me your phone." "It died 6 hours ago. Where's the fire?" I got down on all fours and scrambled into the dark beneath the work table, a space that stank of mice, dust, and rust. "I've got to talk to people. FBI, maybe," I said. "See that typewriter? There's no E on it, and no H either." "And you want the FBI to investigate? I don't think crimes against the alphabet fall under their jurisdiction." I put my face through a cobweb and snatched it off my nose. I set my palm down on the blade of a rusty screwdriver and hissed, "I can't see a damn thing!" "I can help you look," Templeton said, getting down on all fours and scrambling in under the work table with me. "Here," Ursula said. "I've got a flashlight. Maybe this will help." "Thanks, Ursula," I said automatically, for a half an instant forgetting who I was calling the FBI about. Then my insides throbbed with a kind of cold ache, and I went still. She'd heard us talking and slipped into the garage just as I was scrambling under the table. I turned in a circle and peered out at her and Mark. "Thank you, ma'am," said Mark Despot, taking the flashlight from her, pointing it under the work table and switching it on. I opened my mouth to scream but couldn't get any air. My lungs wouldn't fill. Mark hadn't seen what was in her other hand. He bent over and looked under the table at me. "But listen, girl, if you got someone to call, you aren't going to be able to do it with that phone either. That's out of charge, too. It's like a law of nature. The more you need something, the more likely it is the damn thing is going to drop dead on you." "Isn't that the truth?" Ursula said, and hit him in the back with the machete. It sounded like someone swatting a carpet with a broom. His legs wobbled and his knees knocked. She yanked back with both hands and all her strength to free the blade. Mark dropped the flashlight, and it rolled a little to the right, pointing its beam out the garage door and leaving Temp and me in shadows. As the knife came out from between his shoulder blades, he toppled backward, pulled off his feet. He fell to the floor with a weak cry. I scuttled all the way back under the table. "Templeton," Ursula said, leaning forward, her face as serene and calm as if she hadn't just nearly cut someone in half.
Come on out, Templeton. Come to Mama. She held out her left hand for him, gripping the machete in her right. Templeton didn't move, paralyzed with shock. I put my arm around his neck and stuck the blade of that rusty screwdriver under his eye.
Back away, Ursula.
Until that instant, her voice and expression had been perfectly placid. Now, though, her face darkened to a shade of tomato, and a tendon stood out in her neck.
Don't you touch him, she shouted. He's a child.
Streets are full of them, I said, all stuck through with nails. One more dead kid won't matter to anyone, except you. Templeton shivered in my arms. My scalp burned and my own legs trembled, squatting there under the work table. My voice had so much nasty in it that I almost believed myself.
You wouldn't, she said.
Wouldn't I? I don't doubt you love him more than anything in the world. I understand how that feels. I felt just exactly the same about Yolanda. Ursula took a step back. Her breath echoed in the concrete and aluminum cavern of the garage. Thunder detonated outside, shook the floor. I began to crab walk forward, edging Templeton along with me. He's innocent in this, Honeysuckle, she said, trying to regain her calm but unable to keep the tremor out of her speech. Please, he's all I have. His father was already stolen from me. You can't take him, too. Don't talk to me about what you've lost, I said. Colorado is full of folks who've lost loved ones, all because you couldn't mourn in a reasonable fashion. Couldn't you just plant a tree in his memory like a normal person? This state, this nation, took my husband's life away from him. My good man, a bunch of Georgian oligarchs stole Charlie's life's work, all his ideas, all his research, and this state said he wasn't entitled to a dime. They stole his future from him, and he couldn't bear it, so now I'm taking away their future. The president authorized a tactical nuclear strike. The entire nation of Georgia has been radioactive ash for 3 hours. And as for Colorado and the rest of this hideous money-worshipping country, they didn't recognize my husband's rights. They didn't appreciate the power of his ideas. Well, they're learning to appreciate their power now, aren't they? I clubbed my head on the edge of the work table as I came out from under it, and my eyes just about crossed. Temp could have lunged away, but I think he was too terrified in that moment to bolt for it. I kept the tip of the screwdriver a quarter inch beneath his right eyeball. I don't understand why you sent Elder Bent's people after me, I said. Templeton told me you knew we went flying every night. He said you were going to tell the FAA about our trips in the crop duster. I wasn't even sure I believed him, but then isn't that how people always get caught? Someone robs a bank, then gets pulled over because of a broken taillight. I didn't think I could afford to take any chances. I hope you know I don't have anything against you personally, Honeysuckle. I kept the boy between Ursula and myself, turning, putting my back to the driveway. I saw Mark lift one hand weakly, fingers curled, and heard him groan faintly. I thought if we got help soon enough, he might live. I began to retreat toward the road. No! Ursula shouted. You can't! He can't go outside! My Fanny, that's just another lie. He isn't taking any medicine that makes him allergic to sunlight. That was just a story you told to be sure he'd never get caught out in the rain if you weren't around to watch him. Keep moving, Temp.
No! It's about to pour! Ursula screamed.
Come on, I said. Come on, Templeton. We'll make a dash for it. We turned, and I shoved him ahead of me, down the driveway, and at that moment the world turned into a negative image of itself in a stroke of lightning followed by a shattering blast of thunder. We ran. I clutched one of his shoulders with my left hand, held the screwdriver with the other. As we crossed the road, I felt something stab me in the arm. I looked and saw a diamond-bright nail sticking out of my biceps. I heard a mounting, rattling roar. Less like a downpour, more like an avalanche, building in strength as it approached. I saw the far end of the street disappear in an advancing wall of whiteness, a flashing, brilliant curtain of falling crystals. The Flatirons danced, disappeared, and reemerged like an image glimpsed through a kaleidoscope.
We weren't going to make it to Elder Bent's house. A nail struck my hand and went all the way through it, like a bullet. I yelped and let go of the screwdriver. I still had Templeton around the neck, and I pushed him four more steps to the rear end of Mrs. Rusted's car. I put a hand on top of his head and shoved, driving him to his knees. I dropped beside him. A nail struck me in the small of my back, 4 inches of icy crystal. Another hit my upper left shoulder. I ducked under the bumper and wriggled beneath the car, hauling Templeton with me by his cape. Over the deafening, obliterating roar, I heard Ursula screaming his name. I don't think Templeton realized I'd lost the screwdriver until we were under the car. I was flat on my belly, squeezed so tightly between the undercarriage and the road that I had almost no mobility at all. He began to squirm. I grabbed a fistful of his cape, and it came right off him. I lunged to grab a hold of him again and banged my head on the undercarriage. It was the second time in the last minute I'd managed to catch my skull, and this time I struck myself right along the stitches. A galaxy of black suns exploded and faded before my eyes, a map of the stars and Elder Bent's seventh dimension visible on the far side. By the time my vision cleared, Templeton was out from under Mrs. Rested's Prius. "Mom!" he screamed. I could barely hear him over the bellow of the crashing rain. The road shook like I was sprawled on the rails with a freight train thundering straight toward me. I turned myself around to watch him sprint back for his house. Nails struck him in the back of the thigh, in one heel, in the upper back, and he was flung to his face at the foot of the drive. That's where he was when his mother reached him. He was trying to stand again, up on one knee. Ursula covered him with her body, curving herself over him and enclosing him in her arms. She held him down and beneath her as the full force of the rain struck at last, the obliterating August rain. And that's about all I have to tell. Templeton was transferred to a unit at Boulder Community Health. A 6-inch spike pierced his right lung before his mother could get to him, but Ursula shielded him from the worst of it, and he was released to state foster care 2 weeks ago. Ursula herself had, I heard, 897 nails in her by the end. She was a red carpet stuck full of blades. I hope she died knowing her boy was going to live, that she had saved him. What she did to us, to the world, to the sky, is unforgivable. But I wouldn't want any mother to die feeling she'd failed to protect her child. Justice and cruelty are not the same, and knowing that is the difference between being right in your head and being someone like Ursula Blake. This was all 5 weeks ago, and as you know, in the time since, the sparkle dust has coated the entire troposphere. The last rain that was water, not nails, fell on the coast of Chile in mid-September. The only other precipitation since then has been radioactive ash. Our armed forces nuked Georgia, wiping out the firm that had developed Charlie Blake's vision of crystal rain, and annihilating most of the scientists who might have been able to reverse the process. ISIS fell for fake news claiming that the crystal rain was the work of Jewish scientists and launched rockets at Israel. In response, Israel obliterated Syria with half a dozen warheads. They leveled Tehran while they were at it. Russia took advantage of the international chaos to storm the Ukraine. In Jakarta, it rained nails the size of broadswords and killed nearly 3 million people in an hour, which was almost as bad as a nuke. The president's latest move has been to offer 10 umbrellas on his web store, $9.99 a pop, made in China. Admit it, the guy knows how to turn a buck. It isn't all a nightmare, although some days it seems close. A single colleague of Charlie Blake's, a researcher named Ali Rubiat, was in London when Georgia was baked at 5 million degrees Fahrenheit. Although crystal generation was not his area of study, he had some crucial files on his laptop, and the scientists in Cambridge have cooked up a neutralizing agent that stops crystal growth and might make it rain normal again. It works half the time in the lab, but no one is sure what it will do in the wild. I remember how Yolanda used to send me photographs of clouds and tell me what she saw when she looked at them. This one was an island paradise for the two of us, where we would live the rest of our days in hula skirts, feeding each other pineapple. That one was a big smoky gun that we would use to shoot the moon. Another was God's own camera, taking a picture of us as we kissed. All I'll ever see when I look at the clouds from here forward is weapons of mass destruction. That's how we got to now, all of us watching the Internet, what's left of the Internet, to bear witness when the drones take off from Heathrow to disperse the neutralizing powder. If they can take off. There's a 60% chance of nails in that part of the United Kingdom this evening. I'll be watching myself, on the couch with Mark Despot, who has taken up digs in Andropov's old apartment, and who often lips upstairs to see how I'm doing. We'll be surrounded by half a dozen purring felines. Mark and I have kept ourselves busy rescuing neighborhood cats. Or really, I rescue them, and he pets them and gives them silly names, like Bill Dew and Tom Morrow. His mobility isn't what it used to be, although Mark has assured me he'll be back to chasing tail soon enough. Less than a quarter of the world has power or web access, but everyone who does will be tuned in tonight for the most watched public science experiment since the moon landing. I'm sure the comet cult will be watching next door, Elder Bent and his stepdaughters and Andropov, hoping the powder doesn't work. They've got the end of the world penciled in for just a couple weeks from now. They'd hate to be wrong again. Me, I've got my fingers crossed and a heart full of H-O-P-E, hope. The meteorologists predict that a big storm front will pass across the Rockies at the end of the week. If the Ali Rubaiyat formula works, it'll be coming down cats and dogs. If it fails, it'll be pins and needles instead. If we do get real rain, I'll run right out to dance in it. I'll stomp in puddles like a little kid all the rest of my days. They say into every life a little rain must fall. God, let it be so.
Afterward. These stories were written in longhand over the course of 4 years. I began the first of them, Snapshot, then titled Snapshot 1988. In Portland, Oregon in 2013, while I was on tour for Nosferatu. It came to fill two notebooks and the back of a placemat from one of those 1950s theme diners. After the story was done, I put a rubber band around the notebooks and placemat, stuck the whole mess on a shelf, and more or less forgot it existed. I completed my fourth novel, a very long book titled The Fireman, in the fall of 2014. I wrote The Fireman in longhand as well. It wound up occupying 4.5 giant like-term 1917 notebooks. That left half of a very large notebook untouched. I hate to see so much paper go to waste, so I used the remaining pages to write aloft. At that point, it occurred to me that I was working on a collection of short novels. Most of my favorite stories as a reader come in at this length. Short novels are all killer, no filler. They offer the economy of the short story, but the depth of characterization we associate with longer works. Little novels aren't leisurely, meandering journeys. They're drag races. You put the pedal to the floor and run your narrative right off the edge of the cliff. Live fast and leave a pretty corpse is a shitty objective for a human being, but a pretty good plan for a story. My favorite novel, True Grit, is just over 200 pages long. Maybe the best novel published in this century, David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, is 6 tightly constructed novellas, thematically laced together in an elegant cat's cradle of story. Neil Gaiman's most perfect novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, is not one sentence longer than it needs to be and came in at less than 200 pages. Tales of horror and fantasy especially thrive at a length of about 25,000 to 75,000 words. Think of The Time Machine, War of the Worlds, Jekyll and Hyde, most of Richard Matheson's brief, sinewy novels, and Susan Hill's, no relation, brilliant Woman in Black. You want to be able to read such stories in just one or two sittings. You want them to feel like a hand on your throat. And for me, after writing a couple 700-page novels back-to-back, it felt particularly important to get lean and mean, if possible. Nothing against long novels. I love discovering a big, fantastic world to explore, to get lost in. But if epic-length works are all you ever write, you risk becoming the bore at the dinner party. As the DJ Chris Carter says, don't overstay your welcome, or you'll never be welcome to stay over. I think Rain arose from a desire to spoof myself in my own sprawling end-of-the-world novel, The Fireman. I'm a big believer in making fun of yourself before anyone else can. I wrote it in the early part of 2016 as the presidential race was heating up, and initially, the president in my story was a fatigued, besieged, but basically competent woman. Also, the tale had a much happier ending. After the election, things changed. Loaded is the oldest story in the book, although I only got around to writing it in the fall of 2016. I've had that one in my head ever since it became clear, after the massacre of 20 children in Newtown, Connecticut, that we care more about gun rights in this country than we do about kids. Loaded was my attempt to make sense out of our national hard-on for the gun. That said, my politics are my own. Lieutenant Mike Cole, U.S. Coast Guard, retired, read over Loaded and helped me get my facts right on the subjects of guns and military service. He isn't on the hook for my fuck-ups, and you shouldn't assume he in any way shares my agenda or point of view. Mike is more than capable of speaking for himself, and does in his novels, on his TV show Hunted, and on Twitter. That goes too for Russ Doerr, who also vetted Loaded for accuracy, and provided me with first-rate research on the subject of law and disorder in Florida. Each story in this collection was graced with illustrations by a different artist. Snapshot features the art of Gabriel Rodriguez, Zach Howard armed Loaded with a pair of fine images, Charles Paul Wilson III graced aloft with a couple of visuals, and the team of René Deleuze and Ray Dillon delivered some crystalline eye candy for Rain. The book is a far more beautiful thing because of their craftsmanship and care. HarperCollins produced a lovely audiobook of Strange Weather, employing the vocal gifts of four remarkable performers, Dennis Boutsakaris, Will Wheaton, Stephen Lang, and Kate Mulgrew. My gratitude to them all. Thank you for being my voice. An earlier version of Snapshot appeared in a double issue of Cemetery Dance magazine. My thanks to Brian Freeman and Richard Cheesmar for giving the story its first home and for treating it so well. Quite a few people lent their talents and hard work to make Strange Weather look good. In the United States, they include my superstar of an editor, Jennifer Brell, Owen Corrigan, Andrea Molitor, Kelly Rudolph, Tavia Kolichuk, Priyanka Krishnan, and Liat Stelik. Maureen Sugden has done the copy editing in every single one of my books and has always made my prose much more direct and clear. Over in the UK, this book was loved and nurtured by editor Marcus Gipps, Craig Leonard, Jennifer McMenemy, Jennifer Breslin, Lauren Woozy, Joe Carpenter, Mark Stay, Hannah Methune, Paul Stark, Paul Hussey, John Wood, and Kate Espiner. My mother and father looked at each of these stories as they were written and offered their usual encouragement and editorial suggestions. My brother, the novelist Owen King, gave Strange Weather a read and offered several astute observations. Jill Boza is a sweetheart for reading a late draft and correcting the sorts of goofs that slip in when you've lived with a thing for too long and can no longer see the glitches staring you right in the face. I'm grateful to my agent, Laurel Choate, for looking after this book from its earliest stages to final delivery, and to Sean Daly for representing Strange Weather on the film and television fronts. My gratitude to Dr. Derek Stern for his support, thoughts, and advice. Finally, thanks to my three sons for sharing the sunny days and the stormy ones alike, and my love to Jillian, who is the best of company and the best of friends, no matter what the weather. Joe Hill, March 2017, Exeter, New Hampshire.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Strange Weather by Joe Hill. Snapshot, performed by Will Wheaton, was directed by Gabrielle DeCure and recorded at Skyboat Studios in Los Angeles. Loaded, performed by Stephen Lang, was directed by John Runnett and recorded at Suburban Soul Studios in California. Aloft, performed by Dennis Boutsakaris, and Rain, performed by Kate Mulgrew, were directed by Katie Estroka and recorded at CDM Studios in New York City. The Afterword, read by Joe Hill, was directed by Katie Estroka and recorded at Mill Pond Music Studio in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Post-production by Kessler Media. Executive producer, Katie Estroka. Text copyright 2017 by Joe Hill. Production copyright 2017 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.